Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How have attorneys shaped American culture, literature, and law? More than half of all U.S. presidents have had backgrounds as lawyers, along with a number of our most revered diplomats, legislators, and orators. And while lawyers are often the target of cheap shot jokes, nobody who has ever relied on one to advocate for them in a serious dispute would downplay the importance of their knowledge and skills. My guest today is proud to be part of the legal profession and has written a book about some of his most treasured role models. Talmadge Boston is a commercial trial and appellate litigator with Winstead PC in Dallas. His new book is called Raising the Bar, the Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. Talmadge, welcome to Think.
Glad to be here, Chris.
So you start the book with, you do an interesting thing. You have a chapter about Abraham Lincoln, who of course was real, and Atticus Finch, who we think of as a fully fictional character, but the truth is a little more subtle than that.
Yes, Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird's father, was a small town lawyer who did great things. And she admitted during the time she was still giving public interviews that the character Atticus Finch was modeled on her father's specific incidents that had occurred in his career that he had told her as a child. So To Kill a Mockingbird is actually more of a memoir than it is a novel. In chapter one, you see the similarities in what made Abraham Lincoln great as a compared to what made Atticus Finch great. And so that's why it was a natural idea to put them together.
Mm-hmm. One of the really interesting things about Atticus Finch, the character, is that money is not his chief motivator. A lot of people have this really cynical idea that lawyers are just out to make money.
Well, there's reasons why they reach that conclusion. I mean, you see the billboards, you see the television ads, you hear the lawyer jokes and this perception that it's the lawyers who get rich and their clients suffer. And so that image has been portrayed in so many different ways. And that's what caused people to think negatively of the legal profession. And so what I'm trying to do with the book is just to help people see the big picture. And yes, there are a few bad apples in every barrel, but the overwhelming majority of people are doing a great job for their clients. And the top part of the barrel are people who've actually helped America become a better country.
Mm-hmm. Talk about Lincoln and how his early career in law really prepared him, for one thing, to communicate effectively with the American people.
Well, as a consummate trial and appellate lawyer, he was great as a speaker. He was also great as a writer. He knew how to use words with maximum impact, maximum persuasive effect. And he also, as a lawyer involved in lawsuits, was a real advocate for trying to achieve settlement rather than going to trial. So in that respect, he was a real consensus builder. So those were the main tools in his lawyer toolkit, and those were the main tools that allowed him to become such a great president. But more importantly, really, as we think back on the Civil War and the real constitutional issues in play, his being able to be a lawyer who could confront those constitutional issues and take the lead in making sure that he did what was necessary in order to preserve the Union, that would not have happened had he not been a consummate lawyer.
You also remind us that Lincoln was a lifelong learner and really curious, and that allowed him to be flexible enough to see himself and the country through really the most turbulent time in our history.
Well, all lawyers had better be quick learners. The difference between Abraham Lincoln and most of us is once something stuck in his head, it never left. He had a hard drive that once information got imprinted on it, it stayed there, such that he said he never, once he had completely thought through an issue, he never backtracked. And obviously not many politicians these days can say that. But he was a very shrewd, logical thinker who could translate that into words, tight sentences, tight paragraphs, and that's why his speeches are among the most revered in American history.
He also had a remarkable sense of humor, and I wonder how important that is in the profession.
Well, anybody who's ever tried a jury case knows that you better have a good sense of humor because that's what a jury's going to relate to more than anything else. But just in dealing with people in any sort of conflicted situations, wit and humor are always useful. You don't want to overdo it. Your job is not to be a comedian. But if you can bring a little lightness to an otherwise tense dialogue, then that dialogue's probably going to go farther.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back and talk about Atticus Finch a little bit more. Compassion played a big part in the character's life and in his approach to his work.
Well, absolutely. And in that small Alabama town where there was such a prejudiced atmosphere, and to represent Tom Robinson, a black man, in front of an all-white jury, knowing the spirit of the community, knowing that he would be denigrated in the community for taking on the responsibility of representing Tom Robinson, took a great deal of courage. But not only did he agree to the representation, he then went out and did the best he could do. Anybody who's read the book or seen the movie realized Tom Robinson, in fact, was innocent, that the real villain was the victim's father, who had done things to her. But nonetheless, because of the times, it was impossible for the jury to agree on innocence, and so Tom Robinson was convicted. But it's all about representing an unpopular client in an unpopular case and the courage that that takes, and that is a hallmark of our profession, that throughout American history, we've had lawyers who've been willing to do that. I talk in the book about Leon Jaworski living in Houston, Texas in the early 1960s, taking on the responsibility to represent the United States government against Ross Barnett, the governor of Mississippi, and trying to cause Mississippi to comply with the Fifth Circuit order that Ole Miss, in fact, would become integrated. Well, that was a very unpopular stance. Friends turned away from him. Companies jerked their business from his law firm. But he was standing up for the right thing, recognizing that all American citizens have certain rights that they're entitled to, one of which is to be represented fully at a trial on the merits, particularly when your life's on the line in a criminal case.
Was it a professional risk for Leon Jaworski, to have represented James Meredith? Was there a chance that no one would hire him again? Was that something he was concerned about?
Well, he didn't represent James Meredith. He represented the United States government in that there was a United States Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals order saying Ole Miss needed to integrate. The governor of Mississippi was flouting that order and saying, as a matter of state's right, he was not required to obey it. So the beneficiary of Leon Jaworski's work was James Meredith and all others who came to Ole Miss after integration occurred. But he was an advocate for preserving the orders of the federal court and making sure that nobody would think that he could put himself above the law and disregard a federal order.
Years later, and I think this is fascinating, he had voted for Richard Nixon, really liked Nixon. But then when it became apparent that there may have been some wrongdoing there, did not shy away from pursuing justice.
Well, a lawyer's job is to pursue the truth. And regardless of what we may think we know about somebody or what we may think we know about a situation, until you get into it and dig diligently into the facts, you don't know what the truth is. It did not take Leon Jaworski long after he was appointed Watergate special prosecutor to hear some of the early tapes that had been produced and realize that Richard Nixon had engaged in criminal conduct by specifically directing his insiders as to how they should avoid telling the truth in the grand jury investigation. At which point Jaworski told Alexander Haig, White House Chief of Staff, the President of the United States needs to hire himself a good criminal defense lawyer because it appears to me he's engaged in criminal misconduct. So Jaworski was all about the search for the truth. And lawyers like me and everybody else, you go into cases with certain preconceived ideas, but invariably the deeper you go in your search for the truth, you realize that you didn't know it all in advance. There's a lot more perspectives to be considered, and as long as you're using the truth as a sword to get to the right result, then you're doing your job as a lawyer.
All of that requires a great faith in the American justice system, the legal system, which is, anybody will say, flawed in some ways.
Well, on the one hand, it's flawed. Nothing that we as people do is ever perfect. It has warts. It has weaknesses. And that's always going to be the case. And the mere fact that it is not perfect does not mean that we should cast aspersions on it. We should recognize this is the best system of justice in the world. And so if you want to focus on the flaws as opposed to focus on the strengths, then from my perspective, you're missing the point. Because nowhere else in the world is there a system where the overwhelming majority of the citizens basically have confidence in, recognizing that from time to time things go wrong, innocent men get incarcerated, plaintiffs are the beneficiary of runaway juries, etc. These things happen. But overall, put it in perspective, the number of great results, fair results compared to the strange results, and we've got the system that stands apart from the rest of the world.
You know, jumping back again to Atticus Finch, I think one of the most moving scenes in the book for me is when, at the very end, when Atticus believes his son, Jem, may have committed a crime, he could easily have been given special treatment had he asked for it. He's, you know, friends with the sheriff. But in fact, he says, I'm not going to ask for any of that. I'm going to trust that this will resolve itself.
Well, again, what was the truth? And he thought he understood the truth, and he certainly weighed in on the truth. And that's what lawyers are supposed to be and what we're supposed to do. And that's part of the reason why in the last 40 years, particularly since the Watergate crisis, there have been too many lawyers who have succumbed to their clients' desires to shade the truth, resist the truth, prevent the disclosure of the truth. And I'm hopeful that my book will allow lawyers to see the bigger picture, our bigger responsibility. Yes, we have a responsibility to our clients, but we can't lose sight of what it is we're called to do, and that is to be advocates for the truth and justice and fairness in the context of the true facts as opposed to only a portion of the facts.
Talk a little bit about the role of pragmatism in the effective practice of law.
Well, the role of pragmatism in law is like the role of pragmatism in politics, and that is if you are 100% idealistic and therefore unwilling to see the other side, unwilling to compromise on certain points, then you will never make a deal. We see that now with Congress and their polarization, their inability to affect legislation to address our problems. In the book, I focus largely on James Baker as the man who created the term principled pragmatism. And he relied on his former boss, Ronald Reagan, when he was Reagan's chief of staff, who said, I'd rather get 80% than to go over the cliff with my flag flying. Occasionally lawyers or sometimes clients will say, no, if I can't have every single point I want, then I'm not going to enter into that agreement. Well, then they get to go to war in litigation and they look back and say, man, I should have taken that deal when it was over. That's a whole lot better than the final result after trials, appeals, etc. So my perspective as a trial and appellate lawyer is always to be mindful on what the client really wants, and that is resolution, prompt resolution, and to be able to achieve a settlement that gets you most of what you want, ends the expense, ends the uncertainty, ends the anxiety associated with being involved in a lawsuit. That's what the client is looking for. And James Baker, growing up professionally in the legal community in Houston, being aware of that, negotiating big deals, that laid the predicate for his ability to make great deals as the Secretary of Treasury under Reagan and then as Secretary of State under Bush 1.
And you remind us that Baker also recognized the importance of using empathy in negotiation.
Well, you see throughout the book, so did Abraham Lincoln, so did Atticus Finch. I mean, part of a lawyer's responsibility is not only to represent his or her client, but to put yourself in the position of the person on the other side of the table. What is he or she thinking? What do they want? What is, Baker says, what are their red lines? What are my red lines? Let's see if we can figure out a way to make this work. It's about synergy, and that only comes if you are thinking not only about yourself and your client, but the needs of the other side. That's the way deals get struck. And getting back to your question a minute ago, I think that's why Congress is now so polarized. Nobody is willing to get in the position of seeing the other side.
My guest is Talmadge Boston. He's a commercial trial and appellate litigator with Winstead PC and author of the new book Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in about 2.5 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Talmadge Boston. He's a commercial trial and appellate litigator with Winstead PC and author of the new book, Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I'm curious about the chapter you have in the book about Theodore Roosevelt, who, of course, was not a lawyer. He's almost an example of what not to do in some cases, despite his successes in many realms.
Well, whether you're a lawyer or something else, I think all of us can learn from the life of Theodore Roosevelt, which is so well chronicled. We know everything about the life of Theodore Roosevelt. And one of the biggest problems lawyers face over the course of history is the problem of burnout and the ability to achieve a work-life balance, etc. And Theodore Roosevelt's life is a story of somebody who burned himself out and died at age 60, just totally out of gas because he had gone 24/7, 365, decade after decade, and just totally burned himself out. So that's a lesson for lawyers, which we have a problem in our profession with alcohol and some with drugs and some with just losing control of their lives. And it's all about pacing and maintaining a balance. So there's a lot to learn in that respect. But more importantly, Roosevelt, after he left the White House, became an aggressive antagonist toward the rule of law and ran for president on the Bull Moose ticket, seeking to change the laws so that judicial decisions could be overturned, justices of the Supreme Court could be recalled, really became a dangerous political demagogue. And so that part of the chapter is, again, what is the lawyer's responsibility? Well, one of the lawyer's responsibilities is to protect society from political demagogues. And we see that throughout history, but it's particularly magnified since Roosevelt is somebody who we're all familiar with. Most regard him as an American hero. Most have lost sight of the fact that the last 10 years of his life was a true downward spiral that has an important lesson for lawyers and all who believe in the rule of law in society.
Your sense is that he had absolutely lost his moral compass at this point.
Well, I wouldn't say his entire moral compass. I mean, he was still, a faithful husband. I'm not saying he was in any way dishonest. I'm not saying he was sneaky. I'm saying that he was power crazed and that it was the world according to Theodore and no one else's perspective could possibly be as good as his. And anybody who disagreed with him, whether it be the Supreme Court or anybody else, we should find a way to put that person out of a position to opposing his perspective. So it was more that problem of just becoming more and more ingratiated in his ego, his perspective, and losing sight of the very empathy you talked about before the commercial break, an openness to consider other points of view. The older he got, the less able he was to do that.
So lurking, Talmadge, at the edge of this conversation throughout the hour has been where the line of separation should be between politics and between the legal system. And one concern that you have in the state of Texas is that we have partisan elections for judges.
I do have that concern. And on the back of my dust jacket, you see an endorsement from Wallace Jefferson, Chief Justice of the Texas Supreme Court, who's been the leader in our state in saying that partisan political election of judges is a bad idea. And in my final chapter, I address that where you have in the political realm in Texas, it becoming more and more costly for judges to run for election. Well, whoever is supporting their campaigns financially with big dollars are often lawyers and law firms or parties involved in litigation. Well, when that lawyer enters that judge's courtroom, too often he is in a favored position, particularly if he's against a lawyer who may have supported that judge's opponent or even stayed out of it. And another chapter of my book is on lawyer novelists, and John Grisham, whose book The Appeal 3 years ago came out and addressed this very problem of judges being bought and paid for by the companies whose cases were in their courts, in that case the Mississippi Supreme Court, and how frightening that situation is. And anybody with a sense of right and wrong and justice and the way it's supposed to work cannot possibly believe that having judges bought and paid for by interest groups and lawyers is in anybody's best interest. So this is a problem that's been confronting Texas for years. We have not come up with a way to deal for it, and we can't expect that situation to improve until we do come up with a way to deal with it.
And one of the other hazards, you think, is that people who walk in to cast a ballot don't necessarily know if they are voting for the most qualified candidate. They often will just pick the person who is with their party.
Absolutely. I wrote a column for the Dallas Business Journal a couple of years ago where I guess it was the 2008 election, where you had hundreds, if you're in Dallas County, you had hundreds of choices to make. Obscure justice of the peace judges, county courts at law, district judges, courts of appeal, criminal courts, family courts, so many different choices. Well, there's no way even a full-time lawyer can understand who all those people are and who is better qualified than the other. And if you know that in your core, either you're a Democrat or in your core you're a Republican, you can walk in that booth and pull a straight party ticket and be out in 15 seconds, as opposed to going race by race and making an informed decision. And so most people are taking the easy road and pulling the straight ticket so they can be on their way, feeling like, well, if so-and-so is a Republican candidate for judge, well, then he's got to think the way I do. He's got to be the best judge. Well, sometimes that's true and sometimes that's not. And so I advocate in the book straight party ticket should not be permitted in judicial elections, no judicial candidate should be identified with a party so that somebody doesn't receive votes merely because he happens to be aligned with a particular party. We need to be in a position where we're picking judges on the basis of their wisdom, their temperament, their sense of fairness, et cetera, as opposed to what political party they're a member of.
What makes a good judge? Beyond simply being a good lawyer, what does it take to be a good judge?
A good judge is well steeped in the law, both what the statutes are and what the cases and precedents say. A good judge is open to considering new horizons. Sometimes the law needs to be expanded beyond existing precedent. A new judge needs to be respectful toward both sides and have a calm judicial temperament. A good judge has to be decisive. Too many times, very difficult questions will get presented to judges, and they'll sit on them and take them under advisement. Sometimes you wait weeks. Sometimes you wait months. In some cases, you wait years to rule. That is totally unacceptable. And so these are the characteristics in my mind that come to mind immediately as to what I'm looking for in a judge, and I don't care what political party he or she is a member of.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email and join this discussion that way to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones now to Tom in Dallas. Hello, Tom.
Yeah, hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, my question for your guest is his opinion about having equal rights under the law. I have noticed that there have been few, if any, prosecutions of the massive fraud that was committed prior to the Great Recession of 2008-2009. And also, the U.S. government has failed to indict Bush or any of the Bush administration officials for admitted war crimes, such as waterboarding prisoners. I just wanted to know his opinion about whether the ordinary citizen can really feel confident that he has equal rights under the law.
Well, that is one of the great challenges we all face, because obviously lawyers cannot normally be in a position to work for free. And so if you're going to be able to have a law office and all that it entails, you need to be in a position where you're attracting income so as to be able to pay your bills and support yourself. And so many times the people who are society's victims do not have the financial resources to be in a position to hire lawyers, and so they are the victims. I will tell you that the State Bar of Texas and the Dallas Bar Association have been proactive at raising funds to empower lawyers to be in a position to represent those who don't have the resources to hire lawyers. But it is an ongoing problem, but it's one that we are facing. We're not in denial about. The first part of your question about the Wall Street people, that goes to the other side of the issue. They can hire the very finest lawyers in the world who can come up with strategies to get them better deals than if they were not as well off as they are. So as I said at the beginning of this interview, I'm not here to say that the system is perfect or that everybody involved with it always does the right thing. I think you raise a good problem, but it's not one that we're not facing and doing all we can to improve the situation.
You write here about the fact that fewer and fewer civil cases are going to jury trials in the present day. And I don't have the exact figures, but they've diminished significantly over the past 20 or 30 years. First of all, what's the reason for that? And as you ask in the book, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, the reason, there are a few reasons. Number one, in civil trials over the last 40, 50 years has been the rise of discovery, such that before we go to trial, I know what your documents are, you know what my documents are, I've taken your deposition to get your perspective on all aspects of the case, you've done that of me, and so somebody who, to my point a few minutes ago, does not want to be stuck in a lawsuit for the next 3 or 4 years and an appeal can figure out, here are all the facts, and guided by a good lawyer, here is the likely result, and handicap the likely outcome, and then be in a position to make a fair deal under all of the pertinent circumstances, as opposed to rolling the dice at trial where there are always unexpected things that happen, whether it be with juries or with judges, or on appeal, unexpected things that happen with appellate courts. And so discovery is a big part. People would rather make their own choices and control their own destinies by reaching agreements as opposed to putting your fate in the hands of somebody who you don't know, who can't possibly know the ins and outs of your case the way you do. And so discovery coupled with the advent of alternative dispute resolution, two things in particular. One, mediation, which are settlement conferences presided over by a third-party neutral, often a former judge or an esteemed lawyer who, getting back to your point of empathy, over the course of the mediation can get people to see each other's perspectives better than they ever would had they not gotten together for the mediation. So mediation results globally in about a 75% settlement race. So that's 75% of the cases that aren't going to trial. Mm-hmm. And then there's arbitration. More and more companies, whether it's fear of runaway juries, whether it's fear of protracted appeals, for different reasons, put into their commercial contracts arbitration provisions. And that takes the case out of the courtroom, puts it into a private scenario where there's confidentiality, unlike in a jury trial or any trial in a courtroom. And so they choose arbitration. Now, once they get into it, it's not perfect. Sometimes the arbitrators rule the wrong way. And when they do, it's binding. You're stuck. There's no right of appeal. And people who have a bad experience with arbitration results decide that maybe in their next commercial contract they're going to strike the arbitration provision. But put together the discovery and the mediation and the arbitration, and that is why you're seeing a substantial reduction. In fact, Mark Curtin in the Dallas Morning News a couple of weeks ago said that from 1996 to 2011, the number of civil jury trials in Texas has gone down from like 4,000 to 1,500. I don't remember the exact numbers, but just this is just in the last few years. And so I think the decline in civil jury trials is not a bad thing. I think people ought to be able to make their own decisions about their cases and not put it in the hands of a judge or jury if they don't want to. Obviously, it's less costly. It's more certain. But we must have the system in place as the backbone, such that if we do go to mediation and we don't achieve a settlement, we will have that right to trial by jury, that right to have an appellate court hear it. So I'm not saying it needs to go away. I'm saying that its role has diminished as these other very good options have emerged that are causing the decline in civil jury trials.
Are there things we could do to better educate juries about what they're really talking about? I mean, I recognize you have, you know, limited time for testimony when you are in a trial. You know, sometimes jurors will come out afterward and say, well, I think I got that. And you know, you'll hear about the process and that maybe they didn't fully understand what they were deciding.
Well, I don't think that is as much of a problem in that you got 12 people in the room, mm-hmm. and some people get it and some people sometimes don't. But over the course of those deliberations, 12 different sets of ears hear different things, pick up on different things, weigh them as important or unimportant differently. And so that process, I think, is a very good problem process. The main problem to me is that when you are on a jury panel and lawyers are going through the voir dire and they are asking you about the case, and then they give – once the jury's in the box, they give their opening statements, your opinion as a juror for most people is heavily influenced by what you've heard in voir dire and opening statement, mm-hmm. which means your opinion is not being formed by the people who take the witness stand. And so all the jury studies reveal that jurors have basically made up their mind most of the time before they hear the first witness. Well, that's not the way it's supposed to be. So that needs to get addressed, and with capable lawyers, very persuasive jury consultants who can help them to burrow into the right questions to sort things out and play on their emotions depending on their background. In my mind, that's a real problem because getting back to the caller's question, it's supposed to be about what are the facts, what's the evidence, what's the testimony, not who was the sharper, more skillful, oratorical lawyer.
My guest is Talmadge Boston. He's a commercial trial and appellate litigator with Winstead PC. His new book that we're discussing this hour is called Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes and take your calls. The telephone number, if you'd like to participate, is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Commercial trial and appellate litigator Talmadge Boston is my guest. He's with Winstead PC, and he's author of the new book, Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Adam in Dallas. Hello, Adam.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Yeah, thanks first for taking my call, and thanks for addressing this important topic. I've been going back and forth on this with my sister, who's an investigative reporter. And my concern is, as somebody that works in the therapy industry, I'm a touchy-feely guy. I like my patients and desire to have more of what they want out of life. And so what I go back and forth over with my sister is how in the United States, it was on ABC, actually, this weekend. They were saying we have 25% of the incarceration in the world yet only 5% of the world's population. And then I remember in our ethics course in school, they were talking about how we're the most litigious country in the world, and we have the highest divorce rates. And so it seems to me like, gosh, we're kind of an angry country. And, you know, just as somebody that wants to help people for a living, it just concerns me. Like, I'm curious how the author is addressing this in his book, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, we're a country where people have rights and laws that can be enforced and courts that exist so that people can bring their conflicts to them. And so the fact that we have more lawsuits than other countries is not, in my opinion, necessarily a bad thing. It probably means that many issues that should be addressed in other countries are not being addressed. The fact that we have an active system of jurisprudence is a good thing and not a bad thing, and otherwise you're powerless to have your concerns addressed by some sort of neutral fact finder. So I see all of this as a good thing and not troublesome.
Do you have concerns about the statistics coming out that newly graduated attorneys are having a really hard time these days finding work?
I have a real problem with that. My nephew is a second-year law student at SMU who's working hard to be in a position to get a job, and the market is tight. In fact, the profession is shrinking. Technology has had an impact on that. One of the top lawyers in Dallas told me 4 years ago that in 10 years ago, if you had a big merger and acquisition transaction, you'd use 11 lawyers. Now, with all the technology, you use 4 lawyers. More and more clients are pushing back at using young lawyers with high hourly rates to essentially get educated on the client's nickel. So there's all sorts of issues associated with entry level. And I wrote a column 3 or 4 years ago for the Dallas Business Journal on how we do not need a new law school at University of North Texas or anywhere else, because we have too many law students graduating from top law schools who are having problems finding a job. And so we don't need a whole new influx of graduates from a brand new law school spending 3 years of their life and whatever their tuition is to end up with a degree that does not put them in a position to get a real job. And instead they have to go out and handle traffic tickets or no-fault divorces or drum up lawsuits just because there's nothing else to do. So I see all of these issues as being a real problem with the profession that is not going to be addressed favorably as long as we're in the business of putting surplus lawyers into the market.
I don't mean to be overly flip here, but of course they could become novelists. And I just want to make sure that we get to this chapter of the book where you talk about Richard North Patterson and John Grisham and Louis Auchincloss. Talk about the role that novelist attorneys have played in getting Americans to talk about issues that otherwise might be things that are only discussed within the profession.
Well, I think that lawyer novelists are opening the public mindset to the way trials work, the way juries deliberate, the way lawyers deal with evidence, what gets said in confidence that later gets inappropriately disclosed and sometimes appropriately disclosed. And so there's all this mystery and all this drama. What could be more dramatic? Think of To Kill a Mockingbird than the trial of Tom Robinson. And so there's high drama in the trial and appellate world, and so that makes for interesting reading. But there's also this educational component to it. We are a nation of laws. Citizens do find themselves in lawsuits or almost in lawsuits. They need to know what happens in these types of situations, and so these novelists bring all this out and educate us as to the way things are. More and more, John Grisham, as I mentioned, his book, The Appeal, talked about the situation involving judges being bought and paid for by people. So all these legal/political issues can be framed from a perspective of somebody who really knows the law, which Grisham and Patterson and Auchincloss and Scott Turow and David Baldacci and Lisa Scottolini and Steve Martini and others. And so they've got insights that people who aren't lawyers don't have, and who most people find very fascinating, as evidenced by the fact that, for the most part, the best ones have been at the top of the bestseller list.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Eddie on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Eddie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Tell me, I've enjoyed your columns over the years in the Business Journal. Here's my question. If the lawyer plays, and I think it does, plays such an important role in society, and our society clearly still has a lot of stratification along the lines of class and race, how does that square with your view that there's too many lawyers coming out of school if the people who are still underrepresented in the society and economically, politically, et cetera, don't have equal access to lawyers, but most of the efforts we've seen the last few years has actually by people mostly on the right has been to constrict those measures that were designed to help increase the ranks of lawyers for people from those communities. And then just in general, I'd like your view. I think it's pretty clear on the criminal justice side with things like peremptory challenges over the years that locked out people who were a certain race or class. I think on the commercial or civil side, there's equally a problem when you look at the lack of racial and ethnic diversity among judges, among lawyers, among the people with real power in the judicial system, DAs, et cetera. Do you think that's a problem, and if so, how do we address it?
Well, I do think we have a number of African American and Hispanic judges who are on the bench in Dallas and elsewhere, and that is on the rise and will continue to rise as more diversity is achieved, particularly as long as we are in a situation where judges are elected by the population, and as our population becomes more diversified, then we can expect that to result in more judges of diversity. So I don't have a problem, and I don't think there really is a problem in terms of qualified people of all backgrounds being in a position to run and be elected or be appointed judges. You look at our federal judges, outstanding judge here in Dallas, Sam Lindsay, Jorge, I'm blanking out, our federal judge here in Dallas, who's such a great. So anyway, we have African-American, we have female, we have Hispanic federal judges, state judges, et cetera. I don't see that. Now, this is going to take a real shift, because I think you bring up a good point in terms of, yes, we have a whole lot of lawyers who really don't want to spend their time representing the indigents, because that's not a historically a good way to be able to make a living, support a law office, buy a house, raise a family, et cetera. So how do we channel this surplus of lawyers who are seeking to, you know, be gainfully employed or to earn a living income? How do we put them in a position to help the indigent? Well, that's part of what I'm talking about in terms of the State Bar of Texas, Dallas Bar Association, and others throughout the state and throughout the country trying to find ways to get that repositioning to occur, but it's not an immediate process. It's a slow process, and nobody is raising more money than the American Bar Association and the State Bar of Texas, Dallas Bar Association, and others to come up with funding to allow lawyers to be paid for their services when representing the indigent. But it's not going to be a problem that's immediately solved. It's going to take time. It's complicated. But as I said earlier in the program, it's not that we're not mindful of it, and it's not that we're not trying to do something about it.
Would it be helpful if we didn't have a lot of attorneys leaving school with $100,000 in student loans that they've got to get paid off regardless of the kind of work they end up doing?
Oh, it's a huge problem. I was at a meeting right before I came over here where somebody said, a graduating law student said, you can have my JD back if you'll give me my tuition back. And so student loans, whether you're talking about law school, medical school, or anything else, it's becoming very expensive. And if you go through that process, incur that major debt, and then you don't have a job that's going to allow you to be in a position to repay it anytime soon, is a very troubling situation. It's another reason why I say we don't need another law school, so that we can have an increased number of people. I mean, people who who are thinking about law school, will I be able to get a job? What really are my options here? As opposed to just graduating from college and going straight into it and hope for the best. I think particularly in light of the debts that are being taken on, giving up 3 years of your life to go through law school, people need to be thinking a lot more seriously before they make that decision to go to law school. We will always need lawyers. We'll always need good lawyers. But as I said, it is a shrinking market, and if we're going to keep it in place and find a way to reposition lawyers down to the indigents, many of whom need legal counsel, that's going to take time, and it's not going to be solved anytime soon.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hello, Robert. Robert, are you with us? Okay, we will go instead to Omar in Dallas. Hi, Omar.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
My question is, I know he touched a little bit on the reasons why civil cases are being settled out of court at a higher percentage now. I was wondering, does he have any idea why the criminal cases are also being settled at a higher rate out of court than, you know, actually going to trial, and if that's a good idea?
Well, what you're talking about, obviously, are plea bargain agreements that are being made. Let me say right off the bat, I am not a criminal attorney, have never been a criminal attorney, so really don't have any personal knowledge of the dynamics of that. But I think it is a situation, based on what I know, that obviously there's a lot of people who get indicted for crimes far more than could ever go through a trial process. So with experience, with sentencing guidelines, et cetera, people can evaluate what is the likely result if I go to trial, as opposed to making a deal now that I can live with based upon my perspective of the likely outcome. So it's really the same type of evaluation of risk and reward that goes on the criminal side that goes on the civil side. And so given what we know about what juries do, what courts of criminal appeal do, what criminal judges do, et cetera, you can handicap the likelihood of what's going to happen, and then figure out, do I really want to roll the dice and face 50 years in jail as opposed to a plea bargain agreement that I can do now and I'll only have to be in jail 10 years. These are the kinds, just like a person in a civil case, do I want to settle now and get paid $100,000, or do I want to keep on pushing, go to trial, hopefully win $500,000, then go up on the Court of Appeals, and maybe I'll be able to execute and collect on it or not, maybe I won't, as opposed to having $100,000 in my hands today. So we have this type of consideration going on both sides, and I think it's a good process on both sides.
So I know that you speak often to student groups and people who are considering careers in law. What do you want young people to understand before? Obviously, there's a lot of pride in this book and a lot of really wonderful things about the profession. What are the sort of cons you want them to understand?
Well, I want them to understand that there's no automatic job for you just because you go to law school. And even if you do reasonably well in law school, I want them to understand that there's a lot of stresses associated with being a lawyer, where client demands are high and expectations are high. It is a tough job. It's always been a tough job, and it always will be a tough job. But if you don't have lawyers, how in the world are you going to have people in a position to enforce laws and guide people in how to deal with the law in their lives? And so it's very rewarding, but it's very stressful, and more it's a difficult career to enter. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't try, and particularly as you look at American history and what lawyers have done to make this country a better place, going all the way back to John Adams and the founding fathers and so forth, you know, this is a profession I'm proud of, and that anybody who's thinking about it going into it should be aware we are going to continue to have lawyers. We're going to need to have lawyers, and this is a chance to be in the arena, to use Teddy Roosevelt's phrase, and play a vital role in how society works.
Talmadge Boston is a commercial trial and appellate litigator with Winstead PC in Dallas. His new book is called Raising the Bar, The Crucial Role of the Lawyer in Society. Talmadge, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It was a great hour. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show and find out about what we've got planned coming up, and also download the free podcast at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.